This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Okay, so it's a great privilege to have Rabbi Ron Kronish with us today. Rabbi Kronish is without a doubt one of the leaders for a few decades in the world of interreligious dialogue in Israel. He was the founder and director of the ICCI, the Interreligious Coordinating Council in Israel, for many, many years. Just the other day, I was at a conference abroad, and people were asking me about what's going on in Israel, and they said, do you know Rabbi Kronish? You know, it's like immediately, as soon as they think about anything having to do with the world, the larger world of religious relationships, multi-religious relationships, Ron is absolutely the address. And I think I was just talking to him right before we started, saying that some of us have been recently on the tour with Allison, and some of us have had different interfaith experiences throughout the year, and I think this is a great opportunity to both hear about the work that Ron has been involved in many years and also open up for discussion about what's real, what's not real, what's working, what's not working, what are some of the different possibilities that we can kind of build upon, and where are some of the avenues that maybe, you know, need to be rethought. So I think that we'll leave plenty of time for questions, right?
Yes.
About 25 minutes or so? Okay. Say that? Like at 2.
Fine.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Fine. So can we go around and introduce yourselves?
I'm Dana.
What are you studying?
I'm here for half. I'm doing one semester out of the year.
I'm
Maxine,
I'm in the program.
Mm-hmm.
I'm
Faiga,
I'm here for the
spring
semester. I'm Jonah, in the educator program.
Day schools?
Yes.
Hi, I'm Sarah. I'm also here for the spring semester.
Hi, I'm Allison. I'm in the conflict resolution program.
Hi, Adam. Conflict resolution program. Your program.
What was your first name?
Conflict. Adam.
Adam.
Conflict.
Hi, I'm Ali. I'm in the spring semester program.
I'm Jake. I'm in the European Leadership Fellows Program.
I'm Jamie. I'm in the Fellows Program.
Okay.
Yep.
Fellows what? Fellows for what? Same as you?
It means a second year.
Okay. So, it's nice to be with you, and I have a lot of for many years, it's the work that's been going on here in Jews and Conflict Resolution. So I'll take a few minutes with you to share a little bit about a model that I developed in the last several years, having to do with the field of interreligious dialogue and peace building. But before I do that, let me give you just a couple of definitions of all of our discussion. Okay. People in this work today differentiate, if you will, between politics and religion, or between the peacemakers and the peace builders. Okay? The peacemakers are usually refers to the work of politicians, diplomats, presidents, prime ministers, international relations experts and people like that, a lot of them will be coming to town next week and their goal is to try to make peace agreements or peace treaties or peace accords between governments. Okay. One of my friends called that many years ago pieces of paper. Okay, and we have quite a few of them around, as you'll see in a moment. And the parallel track to the political track is usually called today peace building or civil society or back channel talks or various other names. And it refers to people who are not in politics, who are do not have the goal to solve the macro political problems and reach a government-to-government agreement, but whose task is to get people on the ground to see if they can live in peaceful relations together. Okay? So the peace-building world includes the social workers, educators, youth workers, psychologists, people in schools, and potentially at least rabbis, imams, qadis, people in the religious communities who, at least in theory, could contribute their share to helping people who were in conflict or are still in conflict with each other learn to live together, not in the immediate future, but towards the future. So, that's an important distinction, and my work has been in the peace-building work, but we have been cognizant all along of the peacemaking. There's another organization in this country which works in interfaith who does not agree with this philosophy and ignores the political stuff altogether. Okay, he doesn't want to get his hands dirty in politics, and when you talk politics, you just yell and scream and argue anyway, and nobody agrees. Why waste time? And we just talk religion. So we get people to study Abrahamic texts and various things and only bring in the religious thing and leave out the political context. And I kind of personally think that's wrong, so I take a different stance. All right. This is working. So I want to say a few words about the peace process, or what I call the political context. And I'll do this much quicker than I usually do when I have more time, but just to make the point. So, the first point to know, as far as I'm concerned, about interreligious dialogue, is that where you do it makes a big difference. Okay? If you're doing it in Northern California or Switzerland, it's easier. Okay? But if you're doing it in South Africa or Bosnia-Herzegovina or the Middle East, it's a different story. Okay? Or to put it another way, when you're trying to do interreligious or intercultural or intergroup dialogue in the midst of an ongoing conflict, or as I put it in a long run-on sentence once, ongoing and not likely to be resolved soon conflict, then it's a whole different story, okay, which requires different tools and different deep breathing skills than doing it in Northern California or even Southern California or places where the national conflict is not part of the story and you're dealing more in some form of community relations. So here we are in the Middle East, and particularly the Israeli-Palestinian. Okay, so in the old days, before I switched to PowerPoint 2 years ago, I used to draw a mountain. And up the mountain.
Is the first bucket Curtis, you still drew the mountain.
I drew the mountain, okay. So I used to draw the mountain. It was better. I had more energy. I'd get a better graphic artist to draw the mountain. But the point is that back in the ancient history of the 1990s, way back then, there was a thing called the peace process. Maybe you heard about it, read about it. You still hear about it, but it's not real anymore. It's just talk now. But then there was a thing, okay, and I won't rehearse all the details, but we had Madrid, we had the Oslo agreements, we had agreement with Jordan, we had the Y River agreement. The 1990s were a decade of political agreements between Israelis and the Palestinians. By the way, it didn't matter right or left. You had right-wing governments, you had left-wing governments. There was a momentum, mostly due to President Bill Clinton, who was at it for 8 years, from 92 to 2000. And there was a series of peace agreements and continual political momentum side by side by violence and counter-violence and rejectionism. Okay. But there was still a peace process. Okay, and there was what Condoleezza Rice used to call political momentum. And people those days believed to some extent in the peace process and thought it was going to get somewhere. Okay. Just to give you the end of that decade, in 1999, after Netanyahu was thrown out and Barak was elected later, he came in at a platform, very pro-peace platform, similar to Rabin, who had been a general moving towards peace, and we would believe in him and trust him, the people of Israel, because people who were chief of staff and Ministry of Defense wouldn't risk our security, right? And so he went for a peace plan. And in summer 2000, he was summoned, along with Arafat, who was still alive, by Clinton in his last year of office, to what was called Camp David 2. Anybody ever hear of this? Camp David 2 was July 2000. And they met for several days. I have a vivid memory that the headline in one of the newspapers in Israel said, "End of conflict in sight." That is, if you believe the pshat, which you should never believe when you read the newspaper, the pshat, what they said was that we had the information, the tools in our briefcases, the various think tank, we could, rational people sitting around the table, could agree and reach the end of the conflict, final status issues, all the issues were worked out, as it were. That's what they told us here and the world, and they went to Camp David on that idea. And Clinton and his team wanted to make it happen. So there was a real belief at that time that at the end of that decade, this was it. Okay, anybody remember what happened? Didn't work. Okay. It didn't work. Why? Depends who you ask. He asks one side, they'll say, the other side wasn't serious. They're not a partner for peace. He asks the other side, well, they say, exact same thing. Okay, so after the failure of Camp David, you have, not the beginning, but the strengthening of what I call the blame game. You have like a bad divorce, and the fault is only on the other side. On my side, we didn't do anything wrong. We're fine. If they would have done X, Y, and Z, then we could have. Since they don't. And both sides, by the way, say the exact same words, just throw in different meanings. Okay, so the 90s was a decade of optimism, political progress. And alongside that, there was a kind of, a small cottage industry in this country of groups that did dialogue with Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs. I'm talking now West Bank to Israel, East West Jerusalem, Bethlehem, and including things that were going inside the country. And there were, I don't know, maybe a few thousand people involved in this thing, but it was a thing. And you could get money in those years from foreign governments because they thought it was a good thing to do. To dialogue with the other, because the politicians were working this out, and therefore, by the end of the decade, you would have an agreement, then the people on the ground should figure out how to live with one another. That was sort of the work. All that came crashing down, here's my joy, and the rest, I think you know the history. It's a short history. It's downhill. Including to this day, three Gaza wars, one Lebanese war, pull out from Gaza, which didn't bring exactly the Garden of Eden, and all of that. So since 1988, which was the White River Agreement, we have had no real peace process. Zero. The last try at a peace process, if you recall, was a couple years ago when Kerry came for 9 months, and couldn't get the people to even the table to discuss anything because everybody by then had made conditions that were so difficult that nobody would even come to to make what now will be called the ultimate deal. Somebody is planning to make somehow.
Stay tuned.
And the ultimate deal is on its way. Somehow. So, but, so, therefore, the last decade plus, which is now almost two decades, 18 years, we have slipped from a peace process to a process of what I call political despair. Okay, the old days used to ask Palestinians, Israelis on polls, how many people in favor of two-state solution? 70% on each side. Yeah, two-state solution, that seems good. Now you ask, how many people in favor of two-state solution? Well, the majority still like the idea in principle. How many of you think it's going to happen in practice? Almost nobody. 5%. So people have given up on a political solution in the immediate future, like next day. Unless next week. Okay, so therefore, the ups and downs of the political process affect the mood and the, what you would call in biblical studies, the Sitzenleben, the ambiance, the atmosphere, the ability, the historical opportunity for entering into genuine dialogue, which has made the ability and the value of dialogue between Palestinian Jews and Israeli Arabs and Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs more complicated, and the motivation has gone way down, and the amount of people doing it has gone way down. There are less believers. Okay. Now, a few words about what we did during the last 15, 20 years, and then we're going to open it to discussion. We developed a kind of method that we did by trial and error, using various consultants and experts and trying this, that, and the other. I always say, in today's world, we would have gone for a master's in conflict resolution and then tried to apply the theory. In fact, today, for example, if you want to get a grant from USAID, CMM, conflict, you have to read their loan proposal and decide which of the four theories of change you agree with, and then write a proposal which then ultimately can't be done here. You can get money for it and then not do it. Whatever. Same with the EU. There are social scientists who sit in cubicles and design modules that are then impossible to do here in the real world. That's just everything.
In defense of the field,
yeah.
Most theoreticians say we have no idea. You should just listen to what the practitioners have to say.
Okay. So, but the funders don't think that. So, I lost my train of thought.
To a different theories and your model.
Okay, so we developed a model by trying out different things. And a few general, what we did over time is we designed dialogue groups, small dialogue groups of 14 to 18 people, bringing together Palestinian Arabs who would be Muslim or Christian, mostly Muslim, and on the other side, Jewish Israelis, who would be Orthodox, conservative, reform, secular, Zionist, non-Zionist. We bring together people in their diversity. Okay? It's not only peace now on one side and peace now on the other side, whatever, but people who don't agree with each other. And we designed, we had a staff of professional facilitators. There would be a Jewish facilitator and a Palestinian facilitator with a translator, because people didn't know both Hebrew and Latin and Arabic. And we did most of our work in the local languages, trying to give respect, cultural respect, to the different people involved. But we had to have a translator. Most of our dialogue groups were over time, not a day, but a year 2 years, 3 years, the longest was 6 years. And we developed a method that took time to do. Okay? And we recruited people for our dialogue groups based on the criteria of each group. So it would be religious leaders, it could be educators, youth, young adults, women. Various people had different goals for each project, but we would go out and recruit people and say, you're invited to this dialogue group for this year or 2 years or 3 years, and we want to tell you it's a dialogue group, which is different than a monologue group. A monologue is what you go to university. You sit in a room, you play with your iPhone, somebody gives lectures, they write messages. That's a monologue. This is dialogue, and it's going to be difficult. Some of it's going to be hard. And prepare yourself for that it's going to be hard. And then we do workshops. And we, in the workshops, we weed out the monologuers and send them to the university. We go listen to monologues. Okay? And so we recruited people for dialogues, youth, young adults, women, religious leaders, educators. Those were our five target audiences of the audience. And we did many years of these dialogues. And here's kind of the summary of what we learned. So the first thing we do in the dialogue group is get to know each other as human beings. We don't start with politics. Okay. There were a lot of groups in the past, Palestinians and Israelis used to get together, and they would start by arguing about who started the 1948 war. So today is Yom HaNakba, if you don't know, and I heard a thing on the radio. They were having the same argument on the radio today. The correspondent was interviewing Ayman Oda, the Arab guy, and he was talking about the Nakba, and the woman from Reshet Bet said, but we have our narrative, and you started. And Lebanon left, we're crying. It was like pathetic. Mm-hmm. You know, you started. So we don't do that. You know, we don't just start with history. We start with who are you as a human being, and we spend a lot of time getting to know one another, and the goal of that is to overcome some of the very deep stereotypes here that Jews have of Palestinians. You know what they are. And that Palestinians have as Jews, as occupiers, conquerors, aggressors, and other things. And we do that for a long time. And if it succeeds, if it's done well, you create trust between human beings who can actually then talk to each other about something. So that's the first level. The second level, which would be of interest to you here at Pardes, is which we add, and I should footnote, there are very few peace-related organizations in Israel, there are two or three, but not many, who add the interreligious component. Most peace groups are secular, and they think, not totally incorrect, that the religions of the country, particularly two of them, are the cause of the conflict lately. And we should, if we just ignore them, then everything will be fine. Or something like that. I never quite figured it out. So we say no, and we bring in teachers. I understand you bet Muhammad Dajani, who's one teacher, from Islam, or teachers from Judaism, or from Christianity, who will teach about their religion by opening texts and talking about the basic universalistic values of the religion that usually the other side is not aware of, that the other side has one. So most Jews don't think that Muslims have anything related to ethics or justice in their religion. They only have killing and martyrdom and terror. And so when they study with them, they might change their mind or hear it for the first time. So we try to open up people by studying each other's religious texts to the, I would say, the common values in the different religions. And around here, not in America, Europe, here, it's usually the first time anybody's heard that. Okay, because they have no, in their communities, no prior experience to learn anything about the other's religion. And the only way you learn about the other's religion today is how?
Media
and social media, in particular, Facebook, internet, which gives you only the truth about the other person's religion. So we try to deal with that. So it's a tough problem because people have been influenced their entire life here. Islam is a religion of death and suicide bombers and jihad and God knows what. So when they hear it for the first time, something different, they're like in total shock. So you need to do it more than once. And vice versa. Palestinians don't have the opinion that Judaism is the most humanist religion that they, at least not what they've seen or heard about. Okay. So we do text learning, and the point of text learning is to build another level of trust. Okay? I can sit in a room with Muslims who aren't crazy, Jews who aren't crazy, Christians, and we can then talk about things, including we can talk about our religion. Then comes the third element, which I confess to you, when we first did it many years ago, we had a psychologist who was a consultant and worked with us for a couple of years in these things. And he said, okay, now after we do these two things, we're going to discuss what we used to call politics or the core issues of the conflict. My first thing, I said, this is a very bad idea. As soon as we do this, what's going to happen? Everybody started yelling and screaming and who's got the truth and who's got the right version of history and all that. So he said, let me try it. So he tried it, and it turned out he was right, because he had built such an atmosphere over several months of an ambience of trust on all these levels that people in the room could talk about anything that bothered them, even painful issues, even the Nakba today or whatever, whatever's on your mind. And out of that came two basic things. One was the recognition of what we call around here the double narrative. There is such a thing as the meta-Palestinian narrative. Nakba versus war liberation. And there's the meta-Jewish Zionist narrative. But in addition to that, there are seven different narratives on each side. Different politics. Not all Palestinians, not all Jews have the exact same ideas in their head. I'm sorry to shock anybody, but, you know, not all Muslims think exactly the same way as some of our politicians might want us to think that they think. Okay. So, there was also the diversity of the sub-narratives. But the main one was that if you were in a dialogue like this over time, you could no longer say that there isn't a narrative. I didn't say a truth. A narrative on the other side that I have to at least be able to hear. And people could hear it in great detail. People could bring up anything they want as long as they did it from a personal perspective. So I'll give you an example because Daniel asked me to bring up something about Jerusalem, because it's Jerusalem Day coming out next week. So people could bring up whatever is bothering them. So if Yom Yerushalayim coming up next week is a problem for Palestinians, they're going to tell us about it. One year we had a group of it was young people. It was high school students who had been meeting for a whole year, and the Palestinian Jewish Madrachim had an idea. Let's go for a walk to Beit Hanina. You know, that is North Jerusalem. It's a Palestinian neighborhood, and see what's going on over there. And it was all set, and all of a sudden, the Palestinian Madrach said, "This is a bad idea." Why? Because my Palestinian people in the group are saying, "I'm going to be walking in Beit Hanina with Jews in public, and everybody should see me? Uh-huh. I'm a little nervous about this." So there are all kinds of things that you have to be sensitive to before you just go out and do an activity that seems nice and right to you out there. We had another incident in Jerusalem one time where there was some violence or expected violence because, if you remember, they were rebuilding the Furva Synagogue several years ago. They had a dedication. And the word spread that there was some connection between rebuilding the Furva and undoing Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Because every Torah ended with Shanabab Yushalayim of Nuya. So they thought that meant they're actually.
So the word got traveled very quickly in the social media, and there was threats of violence. And so we had a peaceful activity plan to be going. So Jerusalem is an issue, and people will bring it up and discuss the various. Okay, last thing, then I'm stopping. The last point in our dialogue process was the idea that dialogue should lead to action. Talking is nice, it's easy, if it works very well, you have good facilities, it can be great. But what do you do afterwards? Okay, what kinds of action can you take? And we had a lot of ideas of different actions that were possible, from the simplest, which is everybody goes on and writes a Facebook post or Twitter, and to people joining political movements, to we developed a whole thing of action possibilities. The short story, because Daniel asked me to be critical and reflective, most of the action projects failed. Because leaving the bubble of the cozy dialogue and going back to your natural setting where most people were against what you were doing and thought you were a little off talking to the enemy when, we're in the midst of war and so forth, the actions were very hard to implement. There was a lot of resistance on the Palestinian side, the Jewish side. So, not too much happened. A little bit here and there, we can talk about it if you want. But the translation from dialogue to action was and remains, I think, very complicated. And we can talk more about it. Okay, I'm stopping. Questions? Please, tell me. Adam.
Yeah.
Okay. Impressed that I remember?
What's that?
Are you impressed that I remember Adam?
Thank you. I'm curious, what spurred you on this? Like, what started? Where was the seed for you wanting to take on this work?
Okay, let's take a few questions. Please, your name?
Jake. Two parts. One is this peace building for the sake of peacemaking? Like, is that all the end goal, or is it peace building, peace building? And secondly, a lot of organizations, I think it's possible to critique them because they seem to be self-selecting. Like the group of people that they attract is naturally the ones that are open to the kind of thing. So how do you get people around? It sounds like yours isn't though, because you have a wide spectrum.
Right.
So how do you get around that problem of bringing people to the table that even for the first personal encounter, that's very challenging. So,
okay, thank you. Please, your name again?
Allison. Thank you for sharing. So with the issue of moving dialogue to action, I'm curious to hear how you're trying to combat that, or if you've just kind of cut out the action part, or kind of what are the steps forward to make sure that this model succeeds in step four.
Okay. Yes. Again, name?
Sarah. So my question is, how do you recruit people from both sides, and who are those people who finally are recruiting and make the decision?
Who does the recruiting?
How do you recruit? Who accept
yes.
to discuss?
Okay.
And do they have any connections after the program?
Okay. All right. Thanks.
My name is Igor. I was here last
year. Igor?
Igor, yes. I was here last year.
Say it again.
Presentation.
I'm not getting a name.
I-G-O-R.
Okay,
Igor. Studies.
Okay, yes.
I was here last year. Came again. And I was open to see how your interreligious learning through text studying going on. I would love to have a text, for example, a Muslim text, teaching the Muslim people that they should respect the Jews, because I have never come across this, for example, source.
Okay. All right, can we close up? Yes, please, your name?
Maxine. So, you mentioned that, right, it's harder to do this here than in, Southern California. And it seems to me that, the critique I see of efforts like this that are more on the ground and not dependent on political issues is that, it's lovely if people can learn to understand each other, but if ultimately you are a Palestinian, you go back to a markedly worse situation than the Jewish people you just got to know. Like, even if you understand now where the Jewish people are coming from, you're still suffering. I'm wondering, what good does it really do on a broader scale if there's no political, you know, concrete change on the ground?
Okay, good question. Okay. All right, we'll start with that.
Can I just add on to that a little
yes,
bit? You alluded to the other organization that did not have a chance to come and speak there this year, but sometimes often does come to speak about, that is doing a lot of dialogue groups and purposely don't want to connect to politics because they feel that they're going to be able to attract a wider range of people in. So maybe just to connect again that whole...
I'm not asking so much about like whether it's good for the peace groups to talk about politics, but rather... Is peace work really helpful if you are not actually changing people's material conditions?
By any sense.
Oh, okay. But, like, as opposed to... I understand why you might have different approaches within a group, but...
Okay.
It's a question of the relationship between the track one,
yeah,
actual
right.
changing
okay.
structural issues, and civil society.
Okay. So, Adam wanted to know about the seed. How did this get started? So... when I got involved in interfaith relations about 25 years ago, I looked around, and most people doing it were from America or Germany or Australia, and they were doing it in English and German, and they were having the same discussions you could have in Rome or Geneva or America about the parting of the ways in the first and second centuries and why Jews and Christians still or should have something in common. It was very... disconnected from our reality. So I kind of... The story I got involved in was quite by accident. There was an organization falling apart and I was asked to get involved. But once I got involved, the idea of doing the dialogue was not just to be intellectually curious. I would go to meetings and I'd hear learned lectures about Christianity. It's something that I'd be smarter about these religions than I could go home smarter. So I wanted to connect the learning to the reality on the ground. The change I tried to make was to work with local Christians and Muslims and not only those from abroad, and to localize the thing. And therefore, one had to contextualize it in the context of what was going on, of course. So, 1991, and it was after the first Intifada, and then the second. So we were connected to what was going on here. That was the okay. So, Jake and Sarah both...
Sairon, and you moved to the country when?
I moved here 38 years ago in 1979. I started this in 91. I used to be a Jewish educator. I fell into this quite by accident. So you saw on the... I'm writing a book. I've just finished that. The last... page of proofs this week, and it goes to print in the month of August. So, the first chapter in the long and autobiographical chapter in the book is how an old Jewish boy came to Israel thinking living in a Jewish state and discovered that not only Jews live here. What are we going to do with that? And that's what it's going to be about. I was going to subtitle the book something funny like that, but I didn't. It's an academic press and stuff. Self-selection and recruitment. Okay. So we would have a dialogue with women, religious leaders, youth, young adults, and we would recruit in different ways for different goals. So youth, we went through high schools. Young adults, we went through universities. Religious leaders, I did, we went through different people. It's a whole story because I'm a Reform rabbi. We reached out to Orthodox rabbis in Israel through an Orthodox Jewish woman who had been in one of our women's dialogue groups who connected us to all the rabbis. It was quite an amazing story. It's a whole story in itself. But we would recruit people by going after people for certain goals. Let's say the religious leaders, we wanted local grassroots people. We would want chief rabbis, what I call the photo op types. Photo op types, they go to a meeting, they don't say anything. There's no dialogue. There's just nothing. They smile, you get the picture, you see it on their face, and they said there was a dialogue, there was no dialogue. It was just lunch. Okay, so we got local grassroots people, and we reached out to them, in most cases, to people who it was their first experience. Not Beast Now and the far left, who were doing it every day anyway, or what they call in the religion business. We didn't preach to the choir. We usually reached out to people beyond the choir, not the same five old people. So 90% of the people who came to these things, youth, you know, were first-timers. Okay? And so they had a lot of what we call in psychology aha experiences. Really? A Muslim in Israel is human? I don't believe it. So it would take them several times to, like, get over that. To really, you know, can I be at least single next week? The week after? Because, you know, it didn't match the news. Okay, so we recruited carefully by interviews, by we would do what we call workshops, and one of the critical phases of having a successful dialogue was to get dialoguers in the room, people who were really curious and wanted to learn about the other. And when I think about it, one of the reasons it worked is because most of the people who were in these things stayed the course. I mean, during the very difficult times, Intifada 1, 2, they stayed through because they really wanted, this was their first, maybe last opportunity to meet and talk at length about everything with the other. Okay, so recruitment was important, and it was not self-selecting. We had people from all kinds of places. The goal, I want to repeat the goal. The goal, you ask, is of peace building. It's related to the peace building. At the end, they come together. Like, if Donald does the ultimate deal, let's hope. Let us all pray. A miracle happens. The ultimate deal. And next week, or next month, or next year, we have a deal. Okay, what's the deal? It's another piece of paper. And they have the Oslo deal. We've been arguing about it for 18 years, 22 years. Okay. The idea of the peacemaker, peace builders, is to transfer the deal to happen in real life. I'll give you an example. One of my daughters works for a group called BIMCOM. BIMCOM is planning rights, architects and planners for planning rights. And they don't do politics, but they go into Palestinian communities and Bedouin communities, and they help communities get their rights to build a garden, to build a school. That's a kind of non-political thing that helps communities. Okay, so one can do things on the level that's not the political level. Okay. So, Allison, you ask a very difficult question about the steps forward. What are my conclusions? We once had a discussion, actually, in our office a few years ago. There was another group, there was a coalition of people who got this big grant of hundreds of thousands of euros from the EU, because they had a great person who could fill out the forms and say what they could do. And then they couldn't do the grant. They couldn't do what they promised, because most of it was impossible. So they came and we had a brainstorming, and one of the conclusions was there was a missing element here, and I'll call it the community organizing element. Let's say you have rabbis and imams and priests, and they get the dialogue, and they like each other and they're friends, they want to do something, they don't know what to do or how to do it, they go back to their church. So we were missing, like, tachlis people who planning projects and implementation, not just giving a sermon. Okay, so that was one of the things. We were missing that link. Okay. The other link, I think, was to be more realistic. I'll give you an example. I don't know how many years it is now, maybe 10 years. I think it's about 10 years. The USAID, big money around the world, they spent hundreds of millions in the West Bank and Gaza. They came up with a small pot of money, a few million dollars, and they called their fund, I love it, CMM, Conflict mitigation and management. What's missing?
Resolution.
No resolution. Okay, so this is, but I said earlier, this conflict isn't getting resolved, so what can we do in the meantime? The best we can do is mitigate and manage. A little. If you can write a good grant, say you can produce a little less hatred, or a lot less hatred, if you say you can do it, I don't know if you can do it, but you can get some money. People were getting grants, small, medium, so for doing these smaller projects, not huge projects, that have limited impact. Beyond. Okay, Igor. Okay. Next time, or another time, I'd be happy to come with a Christian and Muslim. We'll do some texts, learning. I'll give you my favorite story on this, and I wrote it in my last blog post. I don't know if I'm going to do it, but anyway, I blogged for the Times of Israel and Huffington Post, so I told the story last week. So for 2 years, we had a dialogue group. This one was only Jews and Muslims. We call it Kodesh, Kolot Dati'im L'Shalom. And the Qadi of Jerusalem, I called that. It went for 2 years and didn't stay around very long. But the opening session, I remember teaching a short learning on, this was Parshat Kedoshim recently, about, you know, love your neighbors yourself, and lower down in the chapter, love the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt, and brought in some rabbinic texts and why this was important. And after I did it, the Muslim leader of the group turned to me and he said, "Do the rabbis in Israel know these texts?"
But it was probably something marginal. For example, from the Sufi camp.
Yeah, no, even not Sufi camp. This is not marginal at all. This is the Qadi, the director of the Qadi, the Dina Shari in Jerusalem. Not marginal. Maybe it's not marginal somewhere. So, Maxine's question is the last one and the biggest one. So, my comment on that is...
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, the question is, in the end of the day, politics brings real change. And all this other stuff is fluff. You know, a few people like each other here and there. You know, it doesn't change the economics and the structure and the occupation and God and all that stuff. That's the end of it. So, here's the story. For the last 28 years, people have come to my home and we'll have this political discussion, and by dessert, they want the answer to the conflict. They've already read the answer in the New York Times 100 times, but they want it again. We all know the answer. And I say to Americans, but politics doesn't solve everything. Did you know that in America? Have you noticed? You've got the Constitution, you got the politics. Creating another piece of paper also doesn't solve everything. And the power of civic society Western society in America, and this country is pretty strong. And in fact, there's a whole theory that if you have more of it, it could influence. And my greatest disappointment is the so-called civil society hasn't pushed things, hasn't pushed the politicians, hasn't influenced policy. And one could say that it might be useful to have some additional organizations who did also policy work. But small organizations with more funding can't do everything. I would say, from my own personal perspective, I think I'm a little bit part of the generation here the last 10, 15, 20 years has despaired of our politics. You know? And so, I don't see our politics solving too much. And I don't think by getting... going lobbying the Knesset is a better waste amount of my time than doing these other things. The critical question, I think, in the end of the day is, that's related to funding, is why the is whether or not, if you had a lot more investment in this type of work, it could influence Saudi oil. And I don't know the answer to that. I think it could. I don't think the investors are interested in that right now for whatever reasons, which is too bad, but that's the way it is. If you know anything about the Northern Ireland conflict, before it ended and after it, there was a tremendous amount of international investment in reconciliation programs. There's a friend of ours. Do you know the guy Meyerstein, the old man? Do you know about them? There's a young Jewish lawyer, lovely guy, in Washington, D.C., Avi Meyerstein. He started an organization, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago. It's called OMA, the Alliance for Middle East Peace. I went to the first meetings years ago, and now he's got, I don't know, 90 organizations below.
What's his name?
His name is Avi Meyerstein. He's a young Jewish lawyer, but they have a director. OMA, it's Alliance for Middle East Peace. You can read about it on the web. And they are working on, for years, they were the ones, they've been lobbying the Congress for this $9 million a year for CNN, which they're very proud of because they added up over the years. And now they're trying, for years, they're trying to create an international investment fund like the Ireland model, which would pump millions into this field. Not millions, not a couple of millions. In the end of the day, when people ask me, what's the return? I said, what's the investment? Make a big investment, make more on your money. That could make a difference. But without it, you're having a lot of small organizations doing small things, impacting where they can in the meantime.
Okay. So we are out of time. Not solved all of the problems. We have another week to do that.
Yes, you have another week. Now all you have to do is pray for Jared and Ivanka and Donald for the ultimate deal. That's all that's left.
Amen. On that religious note, Fadalabad.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.